she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative world where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to the sponsor of this show and a great partner of Mrs. Green's World, the Fairfax Companies. They are true leaders in the business of sustainability, and I encourage you to check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com and see all of the good things that they are doing to be true leaders in sustainability. So, about our show today, I am one of the believers that it truly takes a village to do just about anything. Some people might think it doesn't because they're doing it all. Absolutely not true. Whether it's to raise a child, start a movement, or a business, whatever it is, great things are not accomplished by only one person. I am proud and excited to have the gift of spending this next hour with two people who are a part of doing something beyond impactful, beyond what I would have imagined possible, and it's about many villages, 10,000 in fact. Please join me in welcoming Doug Lapp, Senior Buyer and Purchasing Manager, and Val Shade, Marketing Coordinator for 10,000 Villages. It is a place where you can indeed buy things, but it is so much more than a store. It's a place where you can explore and connect with your global village. It's a place where you can shop and know that every single purchase improved the lives of makers by supporting their craft and providing a fair, stable income. Imagine that. I call it guilt-free shopping. Who doesn't love that? You don't have to worry about who suffered or sacrificed to make whatever it is you're purchasing. So welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today. I'm really excited. Can you tell?
Hi.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah,
pleasure to be here.
It's a just such a powerful story, and I would really like to start with one of the big shockers for me when I started doing the research and preparing for the show is the history. And I like people to tell the history, but in this case, I was like, what? 1946? So I was not thinking about fair trade then because, oh, that's right, I wasn't even born yet. So who wants to tell us about the history? It blew me away.
Yeah, actually last year was our 70th birthday, which is pretty exciting. You're right, we were founded in 1946 by a woman that's local to us in rural Pennsylvania, Lancaster County, horses and buggies. Her name was Edna Ruth Byler, and she was a volunteer for the Mennonite Central Committee, which is an international aid and relief organization. And she traveled with her husband down to Puerto Rico and met some women there that were skilled craftswomen in embroidery in particular, and they were making all this beautiful stuff, and they just couldn't find anyone to sell it to. So because she had lived through the Depression and she knew the anxieties of poverty and the importance of like a sustainable job and dignified work, she decided she'd buy some of their stuff and bring it back to America and sell it to her friends and tell their story. And it worked. And so then she started doing it more often. So much, in fact, that the Mennonite Central Committee ended up seeing the long-term value in that and facilitated her travels around the world. She expanded into more countries like India and Jordan. So she could buy more and bring it back and sell it and create a marketplace for those struggling artisans in America. So she ended up selling stuff out of the trunk of her car at one point, traveling around the country selling to friends from the trunk of her car. She started a gift shop in her basement. She did community sales at churches and universities around the country, and eventually started opening up brick and mortar stores. At the time, they were called self-help crafts, and eventually in 1996, we evolved into 10,000 villages. So now we have 60 stores, give or take, around the country, an online shop, and a wholesale channel.
And I, of course, pretty much want you to name all 60. I won't. I will look it up online, but it's my...
Yeah, you can definitely find them all on our website.
It's my goal to find a 10,000 Villages store, and indeed I will, because I travel and I go to Phoenix and L.A., and I'm sure there are probably in bigger cities, but I will find out. And I just... Sometimes when I'm listening to a guest and you just told that, I ask our listeners, and as I do, just take a breath and think about this story. This is about one person making a difference. It did take a village because she had to have help. But listen to that. It's like I want to take a breath, press pause and say, in 1946, she started helping. And look at what this enterprise is today, because she wanted to make a difference. And it's a model. If you're listening and there's that inside of you, start selling something out of the trunk of your car. Nike started the same way. I mean, it absolutely and positively. My friend, the founder of Nike, was his college roommate, and he literally started selling Nike out of the trunk of his car on college campuses. So you can quote me on that. So what does it look like? It's like, yeah, I don't want to be spreading rumors about Nike. But so now it looks like it's a nonprofit. And tell us about the model and what it looks like now.
Sure. So we're a nonprofit social enterprise, but we are also a retail store. So instead of the surplus income going to shareholders or, you know, people in the States, we actually use that to purchase more items from artisans and expand our market here, which is why we've grown so much in 70 years. That is our mission, is to support as many artisans as we can with steady income.
And I just want to, you know, when I was on your website, I got behind on prepping for the show because I kept clicking and went down the rabbit hole and new features and look at that jewelry. And the beat goes on. Oh, my gosh, they have stuff for kitchen. And, you know, I'm not kidding. Holiday things where you're going to buy things that you're not going to see 50 of in the stores, which is a big appeal to me. But I digress, which I have been known to do. So anyway, now you have you've really brought about sustainable change by bringing their products and their stories to the market. What about the relationships? There are a lot of things I want to cover in terms of that. So how do you even begin? You're good at it. It's 70 years old. When it comes to those relationships, you know, I have like 10 questions. How do you make sure it's fair trade? How do you make sure they're sourcing sustainably? I mean, that's a long question, but take your time to answer that. What does that look like in terms of the chain?
Sure. Well, the first thing is that one of our kind of our guiding principles has been building and, or developing and sustaining long-term relationships. And so our average is probably a little over 10 years, the number of years that we have been working with the different artisan partners. And there's many of these organizations that we've been working with for 30 and 40 years. So that provides benefits to them in that kind of the long-term financial stability, but it also allows us to develop relationships with these organizations to visit with them regularly. We try to visit each and every one of our partners, a lot of them once a year, some every other year, and in some cases every third year. But by being able to visit regularly, it allows us to understand their operations and the way that they are operating in a way that meets the fair trade principles. And then when we are in the cases where we are looking for new partners, we have a couple different ways of establishing new partnerships. We look to the World Fair Trade Organization,
right,
which is based in Europe, and so we look to them to get some basic information to start with. We have great relationships with some of the other northern fair trade organizations, and so we can check in with them to see what their experience has been with a new organization. And we sometimes rely on our partnership with Mennonite Central Committee, because there are many situations where they might have people stationed in country, and we can ask them to do some initial investigative work for us. But then we always followed up with an in-country visit with one of our buyers, just so that we can experience it firsthand and get a feel for whether the facts that have been related to us are actually happening on the ground.
So there's actually a model at this point. You would have to have a model of looking at all the different aspects of it, I would assume, and one should never assume, but in terms of price, you develop the relationships, the working conditions. You have a team, I'm sure, that looks at all of those things.
Yes, that's right. So it's myself and two other buyers, and so we each have a responsibility the relationships with all of the artisan partners that we work with. And so we are, not only are we always looking for new product ideas, but we're always kind of constantly monitoring the operational side of things to make sure that each of the partners that we're working with are operating to the principles of fair trade and are sharing the mission that we have.
And it's with transparency, I'm sure that's way high up. And I want to kind of share with listeners one example, and I'm probably going to surprise you guys, but I really did go down the rabbit hole, and I found one of these things. I love bathrobes. So I went, and I was like, oh my gosh, look at, they have bath accessories. So picture this, everybody. I read about this robe. I can't even say it. I think it's Jaipur block print robe. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. So here's the deal. Oh my gosh. It's like, so I read it and it says, you know, it talks about the colors and it's block printed. I'm like, what the heck is that? So block printing is a labor intensive method of hand printing fabric. And I'm saying to myself, who does this? The artisans imprint the cloth with a wooden block featuring a hand-carved design. Are you ready? I'm sure you guys know this. I'm saying it for our listeners because I was like, what? The printer moves from left to right. I'm already like having my ADD and thinking, never in my future am I doing this. Dipping the design block into the die and stamping it onto the cloth. This is repeated to cover the entire cloth with the intended design and colors. And I'm telling you, listeners, go to the 10,000villages.com. I am probably going to buy that robe because I want to tell everybody this story. Do you know this was hand done? And do you know that there's little blocks? And I know that I am prone to hyperbole, but you can't over exaggerate this. And it's, they're safe dyes. It's the whole deal of what I called guilt-free shopping. So to me, that is just an example of the depth to which you go to make sure we're getting something amazing and handmade and beautiful. So let me ask you... Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go.
Well, that's what I want when I say, you know, handmade and beautiful. The thing that I would think might happen is that you find something that you really like, but there has to be some standard. I mean, consumers can be very, discerning, and it cracks me up because you think of a store like Forever 21, obviously not committed to quality. And I can say that because it's my show, but they're made to endure all of five wearings and then fall apart. But you have to make sure because this is not a $25 bathrobe. It's a $70 bathrobe, which I still think is a great price point. But what do you do when you see something you like and you know there's something there? Do you help the makers with getting up to your standards so that you can carry these products?
Yes. I mean, it really, the interesting thing, or maybe the kind of the answer to many of these questions is that it really does vary because we work with so many different artisan groups in so many different countries. And so we're working with kind of different levels of development and different levels of resources and skills. But in general, quality control is a constant challenge. So many of the products that we are buying are produced in the village, even if, a lot of times our partner organizations might be based in the, in the larger cities, but the workshops where things are produced, so often that's in the small villages, a lot of home-based workshops. And, when you visit them, sometimes you think it's almost a miracle that, that they can produce high-quality products and, consistently, and products that when we get them into North America, can compete with any product that would be produced and certainly in any factory anywhere. So it's an ongoing challenge. We're always inspecting products when the shipments arrive, and there are times when we have to reject a certain portion of the shipment. In a situation like that, then we're working with the partner organization, working with the workshop to help them in identifying ways that they can improve their production methods, improve their quality control procedures, and we're never going to eliminate the possibility of quality issues, but our goal is always to reduce them, the incidences, as much as possible, because it really, in the long term, it's a great benefit to the artisans themselves. If they can learn to make improvements, it cuts down on the amount of rejects that they have, and it actually also allows them to increase their potential market if they can continually improve their production methods.
So that's just, and I think about it, that would more people care so much about quality? But it's so funny that for me, when I buy something online, I really want it to be good quality. And hopefully I take that same, attitude to the store. But buying something that you haven't seen is different. So that's a real commitment to quality. I'm interested about, in terms of the design, do you ever see something that is like hopeful and would be good, but for maybe the American market? Do you ever collaborate on the design aspect of it?
Yeah. Yes, all the time. Again, it varies a lot, but in many cases, the artisans that we are working with, so for example, the block print artisans, this is a technique that, a craft that has many, probably many centuries of history and tradition. And that tradition and history, it often has certain design elements that are very traditional to their region or even to their village. And a lot of times those designs or the color combinations are not necessarily the designs and the color combinations that would appeal to the North American market. And so, we're constantly working with them to allow them to use their skills, their traditions, their resources, but in a way using whatever, a combination of design, combination of colors, that gives their product a better chance of appealing to the customer in the North American market.
You're right. We who On have colors other- of the year and things like that.
Yes, exactly.
It's very different. And the big shocker here is that We are up on our first break, and I know, it never ceases to amaze me. That's how you know that it's a good show, and it indeed is already. And we have lots more questions to be answered from the 10,000 Villages perspective, and we're thrilled to be talking with Doug Lapp and Val Shade from 10,000 Villages. Stay here with me. More inspiration and exciting things to share. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for listening. Joining me for this hour are Doug Lapp, Senior Buyer and Purchasing Manager, and Val Shade, Marketing Coordinator for 10,000 Villages, a place where you can indeed buy things, but it is so much more than a store. 10,000 Villages directly impacts the lives of 20,000 makers in 30 developing countries around the world. Again, thanks to both of you for being here to share this amazing story. And if I may, I'm not going to obsess on this bathrobe, I promise, but there's a little bit more to be said about that, because I am like, websites to me are my window to Mrs. Green's World. I couldn't do this show without them. And one of the aspects I love that I think our listeners will love, when you go to an item, there's information about the maker, there's real pictures. And the thing that struck me about the bathrobe, Doug, you touched on it. This is a craft that without having a market like 10,000 Villages to purchase it, it'll die. I mean, let's be honest. There are things that are happening that is not efficient. A machine and a robot could do it a lot faster. But people like me, and there are millions of me's out there, want to know that somebody did this. Somebody put their hands on it. Somebody got paid for it. And it's not made by a machine. So I think that's another aspect that I'm sure you are more than aware of. You're preserving trades that would be lost. Is that accurate and fair to say?
Yes, I think that would be that would definitely be fair to say. Again, it varies from group to group, but and I've seen that in the 15 years that I've had the privilege to work as a buyer, because many especially in the European fair trade world, a lot of our compatriots there have shifted away from the handcraft market and more towards food, consumables, coffee, grains, bananas.
Right.
And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. They're still, you know, they're still buying from communities in the developing world. But what the impact that I have seen is on our partners that work in handcraft and some of these very traditional designs. It's made it a little bit more difficult for them. Their market has in Europe has been shrinking. And so it's driven home to me how important it is to continue this work here in North America and help to preserve the craft, but also help them, the people that have the skills in that craft to, it gives them an opportunity to earn the income from the skills that they've learned, keep that tradition going. And also, even in many cases, it allows them to earn a living by staying in their local community, as opposed to moving into one of the larger cities and trying to find work where there is a little bit more opportunity.
Yeah, and you're right. That's a very complex carbohydrate, as I would say, because sometimes the cities have more opportunity and then more challenges and living conditions. So there's so many pieces to this that are far-reaching impacts with, you know, pebble in the pond. When it comes to, this is, like I said, I never play stump the guest, but you started out, and I think you said, have you ever carried goods from made in the United States? Are there artisans that you feature there? And to me, it's like, think globally, act locally. It's not any type of a judgment, but are there artisans that you do use from the United States, or is your mission to focus on the developing countries that really need our help?
Yeah, that our mission would be to source our products internationally. We do partner with some North American-based fair trade organizations. We know that there's need here in North America as well. It's just that part of our DNA and our mission has been to focus on the artisans in the developing world.
Yeah, and then what you do here, which is so laudable, is you create jobs for people to work in the stores that you have. So to me, it's a perfect marriage of, you know, making that commitment to, you know, things are bad in North America, granted, but travel abroad and go to some of these developing countries and there's no comparison. You can't even talk about it in the same breath. So to me, it's laudable. And like I said, then you employ people here. So I'd like to know more about stores versus online present. It's such a changing landscape, ever-changing. You know, people say now 60% of purchasing is done from a mobile device, reservations, hotels, everything. What do you guys have to look at in terms of where to put the next store, or what to do with the, you know, your SEO? I mean, it's a very, you're doing both. So who's in charge of that, driving that bus?
Well, that's kind of two different buses.
And they are big buses.
Right. So as far as brick and mortar stores go, I mean, like you said, that's a challenge right now for pretty much everybody in the retail industry in North America. So we're trying some things. We're, right now we've been investing in pop-up stores, which has been a lot of fun. So we find short-term leases in areas around Christmas time, or, for example, we're opening one in Cape Cod in, I think, next week, June 15th. So like holiday shoppers, and to kind of use that as an opportunity to introduce fair trade to new people where we didn't have a permanent store in the first place. And so far, our pop-up stores have been really successful and a lot of fun, and we've been meeting a lot of new people with them. But as far as our e-commerce website, we've been building on that since 2006, I believe, and we're getting better and better. We have a lot of different products, and we have a lot of different kinds of customers, and so we're really active in social media, and we're active. We have our own blog, which is actually really great because it kind of shares with our customers how to bring fair trade home, trying to make fair trade a little bit more accessible. It's kind of a big idea, and I think it has some connotations sometimes of, you know, like hippies. at least when I grew up, that's kind of the, and that's just not true anymore. I mean, fair trade is just conscious consumerism in general is so popular of an idea, and especially the millennial generation, and so we're trying to make it a little bit more conversational, a little bit more easily accessible on our website, and it's been working. So,
And there's part of that. I mean, let's just go with that for a little bit because it's such a good one to talk about. I mean, to me, I was at my Rotary Club this morning and very inspirational speaker, and I came away thinking everybody wants to figure out the millennials. I mean, they're going to be 75% of purchasing power, I think, in like the next 15 years. And when you think about someone like Carrie Summers, who is the founder of Fashion Revolution, who I recently interviewed, all you have to do is look at her and know she is not a hippie. She is hot, hip, and happening. I mean, seriously, she's stunning.
Yeah.
And it's not that. And I'm an old hippie, and I don't want to look like a hippie. I mean, I just, you know, I have three girls that would not allow that, because it's like, if I ever show up with sandals and socks, they'll call the fashion police. So I understand that, but it is important. And I want to reflect back to you guys, because I visit a lot of websites as my for my role with Mrs. Green, and it does draw you in. It does inspire you to look more. It doesn't look anything like a hippie, except for one that I loved. Every hippie I know would love it, and that's the Planters. The Planters. I'm like, oh my gosh, we all had macrame. My husband used to make
macrame. Oh my word. I know. I'm so excited about these macrame planters that
nobody even knows that word anymore. I was like, oh my gosh.
So macrame is back.
That is just, yeah. And somebody told me the other day, fanny packs are back. And I'm like, yeah, well, good for you. I'm never wearing one. And you can't wear one around me either. So it's like, but macrame holders. And I thought, oh my gosh, that will touch a chord in a lot of people that I know. Because it's like, that's what we used to have. And it brings us back. So it's a balance back to the topic at hand of watching the online presence and building that. It just, it blows me away. And with things like the fashion revolution, I mean, Val, maybe you can comment on that. Do you see any help from that revolution, which I feel is so happening? I mean, I put a picture of myself on Facebook today. First of all, people like to see me, which I think is, you know, I think it's kind of weird, but it's good. I'm Mrs. Green. And I have an outfit on, a beautiful outfit. Both articles of clothing and my necklace are from resale shops, and it's stunning. And of course, everybody who says, oh my gosh, you look so nice today, I say, yep, I got this one here and I got this one there. I'm a Goodwill shopper. And so there is a sense where people are proud of that. And I think, do you see it moving because of things like the fashion revolution, where people do want it more? They want to know that it's an ethical, moral choice of what they're buying?
Absolutely. Actually, to be honest, I'm also wearing a resale dress. So,
can you text me a picture?
Sure. I think something that the younger generation is starting to realize is that when you buy quality, when you think long and hard about who's making what you buy, like the fashion revolution's whole premise, who makes what I buy, when you think about all of the things we buy and how they impact the local community as well as the global community, it really kind of stops you in your tracks. And so things, movements like the fashion revolution, we actually took part in that on our social media as well. We don't sell a lot of apparel, but we do sell a lot of accessories, scarves, woven things like that. And so we're really proud that we can tell you who made what we bought. I mean, we've been revolutionizing portions of fashion since 1946. So we're like totally on board with that. And we've been seeing a lot of younger people communicating with us on social media with our own hashtag, which is Live Life Fair, because we're trying to encourage people, whether they're customers of ours or not, we're trying to encourage everybody to think really consciously about all of the little decisions in your life. We can't change everything at once, but we can definitely make little actions, take little actions, take little steps to start changing things, and that's how change ultimately happens. And so we've been seeing that with a lot of our customers. We talk about it all the time on our blog and social media, and we're lucky enough, since we know the people who make what we buy, we get to talk about it with them as well. In fact, one of my favorite things to do is to pass on, if a blogger is styling what we wear, or excuse me, if a blogger is styling something that we've made and sent to them or they've bought, I get to take that blog and give it to the buyer, and the buyer can send it to the artisan. So everything really comes full circle with us. Just like the fashion revolution, we do the same thing with our handicraft.
And you know what else? This is what I have to comment on. You know, you go into your website, and most people are like me. If it's a good website, you go down the rabbit hole. You start looking, clicking. So I don't know why. I think it really is intentional. But there are things that you don't find everywhere. And when I'm giving people presents, I pretty much don't buy them unless it really I don't like the term resonates with me, but unless I feel called, I don't just buy them a gift for having a gift. So some of my friends get a birthday present, you know, 7 months later. But I know you guys will laugh and it's okay, but there are two things on there that jumped out that I know people that would love them. There's the pedicure friends. And that I want people listening to go onto the website, obviously, but these are handmade in Nepal, and there's a pedicure seahorse friend and a pedicure octopus friend. And looking at those and, you know, clicking on it and reading the story, it's something different that you're, you know, instead of buying somebody a bar of soap that you got at the farmer's market, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're looking for things that are different and that are fun, and then, like I said, all the guilt-free element, I'm sure it's delightful for you when you find things like this. Is that right, Doug? It's just like, oh my gosh, nobody has this.
Yeah, that's actually, it kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, because it's almost like if our products are too traditional or too maybe tied to one specific region, that then can kind of limit the appeal in North America. On the other hand, if it becomes too mainstream, then it also it loses its appeal because you know, it's not that unique thing that 10,000 Villages has that nobody else has. So yeah, what we're always kind of looking for that sweet spot where it's a product that has, it's unique, it's handmade, it has the flavor of the international without being like so specific that it only appeals to a very select market.
And you want to do that. I mean, I looked a lot at your, you know, of course I looked at the purses and the tote bags. I have a cork backpack that I got at a Bioneers conference, and everybody comments on it. And it's a sustainable design. I'm taking it. I'll be in a really dressed up, dressy outfit, and I have my cork backpack because it's just, you're right, it's that sense of I feel like it's still fashionable. And then I have a story about it because it's a renewable resource. And yeah, I would not want to be on the buying end of deciding. Which leads me to a question of, you have so many makers. What about new makers? Is there always room for one more? Or are people? Do you have many more makers and you're able to accommodate? How does that all work?
Yeah, in general, there's a lot more makers than our current market allows. Now, that being said, our partners that we work with in country, they are always looking for new workshops, new materials, new techniques, and so even though it might be a partner organization that we've been working with for 30 years, we have the ability to kind of source new products, new ideas through our partnership with them. But for a direct buying relationship, it's in the current situation, it's really challenging because even as we've grown, the market is still limited, and so we need to be careful not to have a negative impact on one of our existing partnerships by bringing in somebody that might compete with them.
It makes so much sense. I mean, it's a delicate balance because you want to give somebody else a chance, but you want to take care of the people that you invested in and that you have a long-standing relationship with. Again, so glad that I don't have to be making that decision. So we're coming up on another short break, and if you just joined us, what an engaging, impactful conversation with Doug Lapp and Val Shade from 10,000 Villages. And when we come back, what I'd really like to talk about is there are some very interesting, the new products that you're covering, because I think lots of people are now talking about mind, body, spirit. I know that even I did a blog on my newsletter on getting in touch with spirit and that part of us that we don't feed very much. And then I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd like you to talk with us about some of your biggest challenges. I mean, what kind of obstacles do you face, and in terms of supply and spreading the word and even educating the consumers? So everybody, we are going to, you know, take a short break and come back and talk about cool things like life in balance, mind, body, spirit, and what the new arrivals look like and what we can expect for in the weeks and months to come. Stay here with me. More really good stuff in this next piece of the radio show.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for listening. And joining me for this hour are Doug Lapp, Senior Buyer and Purchasing Manager for, and Val Shade, Marketing Coordinator for 10,000 Villages. And we talked a little bit before air about editing things out. And I think I'm going to ask our editor to take out that ending of, what did I say, something about the next radio spot? I'm like, wait, is this your first rodeo, Gina? It's like, and what I meant.
And that was poetry. That was beautiful.
That was not one of my sweet spots. I can tell you that right now. And my team will get a big kick out of it. Well, I was looking for the word segment. And to be honest, I was looking at the website and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I want to see what this life and balance is. I want to see mind, body, spirit. So truth in revealing all this, you cannot multitask when you're doing this, but it was a good distraction. So let's talk about, I think it would be kind of fun to talk about some of the new things or the challenges. Let's talk about the challenges first, and then we can end up on a really high note, because I'm sure you face challenges. What are some of those in this very big, bold world of retail, cruel world, harsh world at times, ever-changing world? What are some of those?
Well, you know, part of it is the challenges of working in the communities that we do, because we are very explicit about working in those communities where there is need. And so you have, you know, issues with infrastructure and political unrest. You know, even such thing as climate change. A lot of the areas we work in, you know, they might have had a very distinct rainy season even 3 or 4 years ago, and they could kind of plan their production around that. And many places that I visited, they're saying that is no longer consistent. They never know from 1 year to the next when that season is going to hit. So I think just the nature of where we work and who we're working with is one of our biggest challenges. But that being said, the changing retail market is a huge challenge, and especially since we are an organization that has invested in the brick and mortar model, you know, that the changes that have happened over these past 7-8 years have really made it very challenging. And you know, unlike a mainstream organization, there's certain changes that might be open or available to a normal mainstream retail operation that we would never consider. And so you know, our cost of the production, the products we're buying, I mean, that's not something like that's an untouchable. We're not going to go back to our artisan partners and say things are more competitive here in the U.S. We need you to cut your prices by 10%. We're not going to go to our artisan groups and say we found some lower cost producers in another country. We're just not going to be able to work with you. And so there are certain challenges that come with this model. In some ways we have less flexibility than the mainstream market. I think on the upside to that, there is a kind of a desire for experience and for the shopping kind of process to be an experience. And so for 10,000 villages with our 60 stores, it's almost like we have 60 local stores, because the staff and the volunteers in those stores are very tied in with their local communities. And so it brings kind of a vibrancy that is not going to be found at most of the mainstream retailers.
Doug, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and to add to that, because of the challenges that we face in regards to, like, the places where we work and the people we work with and the retail market right now generally, we have to kind of meet those challenges head on and educate Americans in particular about why it matters, about why fair trade is so important, about why everything you do impacts somebody else. In fact, something I like to say all the time is that we're not consumers, we're a part of a community. And we want to teach people that that's a really important way to think, and that it's not so hard to think that way as you might think. It's a pretty consumerist culture, but we have opportunities to buy better and to impact people in a positive way. And so part of our challenge is to educate people about that in a way that is exciting, empowering, and positive, and respectful of the people who make what we're selling.
And especially since there is a heavy message in this, and you have to make it not heavy, but engaging and fun, and there's some kind of magic to that, I think. And when Doug was talking about it, and both of you, about it's, you don't just cut back on production 10% because it's not an assembly line and maybe cut back on overtime. You're cutting back maybe on what someone can feed their children or themselves, or sourcing of new materials. And Doug, kudos to you for bringing up climate change, because it's impacting everything. And I like to weave it into every show, but I got so excited about the shopping possibilities on 10,000 villages that I maybe forgot my mission a little bit for a second. And I just have to ask this before I forget, but that is what I would love one of the takeaways from the show to be. And it really is all about mindfulness. And when I do trainings or presentations about sustainability, that's what I say. The first step is mindfulness, being a conscious consumer in everything that you do, because that's what drives the engine, is the buying power of people. And I'm dying to ask this question. I'm so glad I didn't forget. I mean, I want to know who names some of the things, because I got across calm mood hamper basket. Like, who wouldn't want to have a calm mood hamper basket? And I looked at some of these names. I mean, some of them are, you know, more what I would call mainstream, but there are wonderful, fun names. Who's in charge of... Are you going to tell me the manufacturer came up with calm mood hamper basket?
No, unfortunately, neither Doug nor I come up with those names. Our colleague Becca does all of that.
Well, kudos to Becca. You can tell her she got me. I mean, seriously. And I'm like, I want a Tiki Hut bird feeder, because it's just, who doesn't want that? I mean, I had way too much fun on this website, and I hope people will be so inspired to look at it as well. And the other question, I'm overwhelmed with thoughts, coming in about the changing landscape and how you guys have to navigate this. And then let's talk a little bit about the new products, because there's some really fun stuff, and How does that all come about? Not just what the products are, but, you know, there is life in balance and really cool stuff and mind, body, spirit. I mean, what to launch something new, especially in these challenging times, what do you have to go through to decide on who's in and what's not?
Great question. So we as the buying team, we are constantly looking at trends, and that, you know, that kind of starts at the larger macro trends, the lifestyle trends. How are things changing? How are people, the way they're living their lives, how are they changing? How is that affecting what is going to be appealing to them as products? We also then, you know, look at kind of more specific trends in terms of home accents, trends in fashion. And then we, you know, when you look at trends, it runs the gamut. I mean, it's from the, you know, the kind of the most simple to the most just far out that you could ever imagine. And so the buying team's responsibility then is to take that information and kind of distill it down and determine which of those trends is appropriate for the 10,000 Villages brand and is most likely to appeal to our customer base. And so we're constantly looking at that, we're juggling things, and so that kind of is the start of the process, and then we start to look at after we kind of have a good feel for what we think are some good themes for new item collections, then we start to look at the products and the capabilities and the traditions of the different groups that we work with, there's times when there's just products that are already developed by the groups that work perfectly. There's other times where there's products that have kind of a good foundation, but they need some tweaking in terms of color or function.
Right.
And then there's other times when we just kind of start from scratch and we're, you know, coming up with product designs and drawings and asking the group to develop them from scratch.
And Doug, I don't know, either of you can answer this question. Have there been some things that you have been involved in the selection of that you thought, well, you know, this might go, and then it was a big wow and shocking, and it's like, oh my gosh, I never thought it was going to be that popular. Are there any stories that come to mind? Again, not to put you on the spot, but how do you, are there times when you're just rejoicing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm trying to think of, we've worked with a number of different groups over the years that have made handmade paper, and so journals have been a kind of a product category that we've probably been purchasing for the last 20, 30 years. And I remember when I first started, it was a relatively strong product category for us. And then over the next, 5 to 10 years, you could just see the sales starting to decline. And even as recently as probably, 3 or 4 years ago, it was a challenge to come out with a new journal design that gained traction with a wide range of our customer base. And so we were still coming out with a few, but we had kind of moved away from that and we weren't focusing on that. And so as part of our spring collection, we came out with a leather-bound journal, a little bit higher price point than some of our other journals. And so when we were, looking at it initially, we thought it's a great product, but, we just haven't We haven't had that much success with journals, a little bit higher price point. We just weren't sure. And so we introduced that in May, and it's actually been our top-selling item from that particular new item collection. So it wasn't a complete surprise, but it still was a kind of a welcome surprise compared to what we thought might be possible.
A very pleasant surprise. And is that the leather, the elephant journal?
Exactly.
Yeah, sold out online, unfortunately. Yes.
It is. It is just, I mean, and I, almost everybody I know, I have, you know, I don't have a fancy elephant leather journal. I might be having one soon. You never know. But it's like, it's just, it makes so much sense because it closes. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I put things in there. So that's a feature that I think is really important. And it's great to know that something like that, and people, I think more and more people are writing things down because there's so much that comes to us. I have one place that I take to every meeting and I write in there. And I think I'm going to have to get this elephant one for my trip to the rainforest in October. So it's really good. You know, as we go into the closing minutes, I'd like both of you to reflect on one quick social media question, maybe for you, Val, in terms of where you're finding the most ROI or the bang for your buck. And then what is the one message or two messages that you'd like to leave with our listeners? Of course, go to 10,000 Villages, and it's all spelled out, .com, and follow you all on social media. But Val, quickly, what is your, you know, social media? What are you finding? Is Instagram in? Please don't tell me Snapchat, because I hate Snapchat. That is not my generation. I'm not doing Snapchat.
You have to draw the line somewhere.
My grandson is like, no, Grandma, you'll love it. And my granddaughter, I'm like, no, I wouldn't. There are some things that I don't ever say I'm too old, but I am not going to do Snapchat. I'm not anything else. But
fair enough.
Instagram. I love Instagram. I can't do it enough.
Yeah, me too. So our largest audience is definitely on Facebook.
Okay.
And our audience on Facebook is very engaged. They are also, they skew a little older. So the next, I would say, most engaged audience that we have is Instagram, and they skew a lot younger typically. So we kind of are speaking to two slightly different audiences on both of those platforms. But Instagram's a lot like a community. So I can be in touch with bloggers, I can be in touch with customers, I can be in touch with other influencers, other brands, and we can partner up and do giveaways and just share, like, I can share customer photos with the hashtag LiveLifeFair, stuff like that. Facebook is really great because that's where we get to share our blog a lot. And our customers, our blog and our artisan stories, which are very important to us and very important to our customers as well. And so they get shared a lot. We get a lot of traffic, a lot of shares, a lot of comments, and a lot of people saying, like, you know, we didn't know that it took that long to make paper, or we didn't know that block printing was so incredible. We get a lot of that conversation going on our Facebook.
And it's really great. And, of course, we might want to mention that you have almost 70,000 followers, which helps having an engaged community. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to see that. And so we have, you know, about a minute and a half, which just blows me away. Each time I have a show like this, it's so wonderful. I just want to say that our June 20th show is Danielle Wolowitz from Kyocera talking about the right thing to do. It's going to be another great show. A thought leader, Dr. Inamori, that started Kyocera, is amazing, making a difference all over the world. And then our Down to Earth show is Mead Meyer and Mike Malozzi on the Inside Scoop about stormwater, wastewater, and, you know, your next beer might be from wastewater. Lots of changes in that going on. You can find everything about that at MrsGreensWorld.com. Just quickly, if you can, and the music will start, the takeaway for our listeners, the call to action. You have 1 minute.
Well, okay. So I would say what I love about this model is that it's not charity. It's based on a transaction, a fair trade. And so what that means to me is that the customer here in the U.S. has to gain something of value. And so we're driven to get products that bring value to the customer here, while at the same time making sure that the producer is gaining value and an income that allows them to increase their earning standard.
What a way to end. Thank you, everybody. Be mindful in your consumption and check out 10,000villages.com. Make it a great, green, sustainable day. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.